Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. Today we are taking on a subject that, well, it can feel both really academic and deeply personal. Philosophy of law.
Or jurisprudence, as it's often called.
Right, jurisprudence. We're going to try and cut through some of that jargon using Raymond Wack's fantastic little book, Philosophy of Law. A very short introduction. It's our roadmap for today.
And it's important because, you know, if you think law is just a bunch of rules written down somewhere, black and white instructions from Parliament or Congress.
Which is what most of us probably think.
Right, exactly. But Wack says, look, that's just the surface. Law is actually this living, breathing human thing. It's tangled up with morality, with justice, power, social values. All of it.
Yeah, that default view law is just this stack of rules. Kind of mechanical.
Yeah.
But Wack shows that behind every law, every court decision, there's this, like, intense intellectual battle going on about what authority even means.
Mm-hmm.
So our mission today, to give you a shortcut, a way into understanding this huge, centuries-old question, what actually is law?
And our guide for this is Raymond Wack. He's emeritus professor of law and legal theory at the University of Hong Kong, really well known, especially for his work in jurisprudence and also, interestingly, privacy law.
Okay, so he's got the credentials. But what makes his viewpoint useful for, you know, us? People maybe not steeped in legal theory.
Yeah.
These ideas, natural law, positivism, they sound pretty heavy.
Well, a couple of things. First, his background is really broad. UK, South Africa, Hong Kong. That gives him this kind of global perspective on how different places grapple with what makes law legitimate.
Okay, that's helpful.
But I think his real talent, and why this particular book is so good, is his knack for boiling down these massive competing ideas into something, well, genuinely understandable. He manages clarity without, you know, burying you in jargon.
Good.
He's a great guide for the non-expert.
All right, so let's unpack the book's main idea. Wack kicks off by saying something that sounds, well, maybe a bit unsatisfying at first.
Which is
that there's no single easy answer to what is law. It's fundamentally contested territory.
Exactly. And that is the insight, really. The value isn't in finding the answer. It's in exploring the debates themselves, how they've evolved. He starts us off with the big one, the sort of age-old clash between natural law, this idea that law needs to connect to some higher morality, and legal positivism, which argues, no, law and morality have to be kept strictly separate.
Okay, the two big camps.
And then he expands from there. He looks at what's sometimes called a third way, particularly Ronald Dworkin's ideas, trying to sort of bridge that gap.
Interesting.
And he gets into theories of rights and justice, too, contrasting thinkers like John Rawls with, say, the more libertarian ideas of Robert Nozick. Big debates there.
So it's not just about what law is, but what it should do, its purpose.
Precisely. And crucially, he doesn't shy away from the critical views either. Marxism, feminist jurisprudence, perspectives that basically challenge the whole idea of law being neutral.
Right. They ask, neutral for whom?
Exactly. So the book's aim isn't to give you the final word. It's more about giving you the intellectual tools to ask better questions yourself. Questions about law's moral authority, its role in society, whether it actually achieves justice.
Okay. Let's dive into that foundational conflict then. Wack throws down this challenge right at the start. Is a law still valid if it's just deeply immoral?
That's the core question, isn't it? Think about, say, the laws under apartheid or Nazi Germany. They were made through the correct legal procedures of the time.
But were they law in a meaningful sense?
That's where natural law comes in. It's the oldest tradition, really. It says there's a higher law, maybe based on reason or nature or God, depending on the thinker, and human-made laws have to align with that higher law to be truly authoritative.
And that famous phrase sums it up, lex injusta non est lex.
An unjust law is no law at all. It's a powerful idea. It gives a moral anchor, and you see its real-world power in moments like the Nuremberg trials.
Right, after World War II.
Yeah. Nazi officials couldn't just say, we were following orders, or we were following the law. They were held accountable based on universal moral principles, crimes against humanity, that went beyond German national law at the time.
So natural law provides a basis for judging national law.
Exactly. And it's not just ancient history. Thinkers like Lon Fuller, more recently, talked about an inner morality of law. He said, for something to even count as a legal system, it has to meet some basic procedural standards.
Like what?
Well, laws need to be public, understandable, not contradictory, not retroactive. You know, basic fairness and how the rules work. If it doesn't meet those, Fuller argued, it's not really law. It's just arbitrary force.
Okay, that focus on procedure, on how laws are made and function, that sounds like it leads towards the other big camp.
It does, nicely. It leads us to legal positivism. And the core idea here, the absolute centerpiece, is the separation thesis. Meaning there's no necessary link between law and morality. A law's validity, for positivist, comes down to its source, how it was enacted, who made it not its moral content.
So a law could be morally terrible, but if it was made the right way, according to the system's rules, it's still valid law.
That's the positivist line, yes. The key figure to know here is H.L.A. Hart. He gave positivism a really sophisticated modern form. He described law as a union of two types of rules.
Okay.
Primary rules, these are the rules that tell you what you can and can't do, like don't steal, pay your taxes. They impose duties.
Got it. Standard laws.
And secondary rules.
Yeah, we're good.
These are rules about the primary rules. They grant powers like how to make new laws, how to change them, how courts decide disputes about them.
Ah, so the rules that structure the whole legal system itself.
Exactly. And the most important secondary rule in Hart's theory, this is crucial, is the rule of recognition.
The rule of recognition. Okay, what is that exactly? It sounds fundamental.
It is. But it's not usually a written law itself. It's more like a social practice. It's the set of criteria that the officials within a legal system, judges, legislators, actually use and accept in practice to identify what counts as a valid law in their system.
So in the UK, it might be something like, whatever the Queen in Parliament enacts is law.
Basically, yes. Or in the US, what the Constitution prescribes and what Congress enacts accordingly is law. It's the ultimate test for validity within that particular system based on what officials do.
Mm. But wait, if it's just what the officials accept, doesn't that feel a bit arbitrary? Like, what if the officials accept really bad rules? It sounds like it could legitimize tyranny, almost.
That's the criticism, absolutely. And Hart faced it head on. He'd say, yes, a law can be valid according to the rule of recognition and still be morally atrocious. But he argued, keeping validity and morality separate allows us to be clearer. We can say, yes, this is technically the law. And we can also say, but it's a terrible law and we should fight to change it or disobey it. It avoids confusion.
Okay, I see the logic, even if it feels a bit uncomfortable. So we have positivism focusing on rules and sources. But WACS doesn't stop there. What happens when the rules? Well, when they don't give a clear answer.
Ah, the hard cases. That brings us neatly to Ronald Workin. He was a major critic of Hart and offered this influential third way we mentioned.
Trying to bridge law and morality somehow.
Kind of. Dworkin said, look, when judges face these hard cases where the written rules are ambiguous or silent, they don't just invent an answer or flip a coin like a strong positivist might imply.
What do they do then?
He argued that law isn't just rules. It also includes what he called principles. These are things like fairness, justice, equity, basic moral standards embedded within the legal system.
So these aren't explicit rules, but underlying values.
Exactly. And Dworkin believed judges have a duty to find the one right answer in hard cases by interpreting the existing legal materials, rules, and principles in a way that fits the legal history and shows the law in its best moral light.
He called that law as integrity, right?
Right.
Making the law the best it can be, morally speaking.
That's the one. The classic example WACS uses is a case called Riggs v. Palmer.
What happened there?
A grandson murdered his grandfather specifically to inherit his money under the will. The will itself was perfectly valid according to the rules, and the inheritance laws didn't explicitly say murderers couldn't inherit.
Oh, wow. So legally?
Legally, based purely on the written rules, he should have inherited. But the court said no. They invoked a broader legal principle. No one should be permitted to profit from his own wrong.
Ah. So that principle, even though not a specific statute, was treated as part of the law.
Precisely. Dworkin used cases like this to argue that law is much richer and more morally infused than positivism admits. It involves interpretation, not just application.
Okay, that makes sense. So we've got the internal debates, natural law, positivism, Dworkin's interpretive view.
Mm-hmm.
But then WACS shifts focus a bit, right? Oh. Towards the purpose and impact of law.
Yes. In Chapter 5, he dives into rights and justice. This is where he brings in John Rawls.
A huge name in political philosophy.
Absolutely. Rawls famously asked us to imagine designing the basic structure of society from an original position behind a veil of ignorance.
Meaning, we don't know anything about our own position in that society, rich, poor, talented, not talented, etc.
Right. Total impartiality. Rawls argued that from that position, we'd choose principles of justice that protect everyone, especially the worst off. This leads to his famous difference principle,
which says
that social and economic inequalities are only acceptable if they work to the greatest benefit of the least advantaged members of society. It's a powerful argument for a more egalitarian structure.
And Wax contrasts that with Robert Nozick.
He does. Nozick offers a strong libertarian critique, emphasizing individual rights, especially property rights acquired justly. For Nozick, state-led redistribution, like Rawls might advocate, is fundamentally unjust, akin to forced labor.
So a real clash there about the role of law in achieving economic justice.
A fundamental clash, yeah. And then finally, Wax introduces the perspectives that really shake the foundations, the critical perspectives.
Marxism, feminist jurisprudence, critical legal studies, CLS.
Exactly. These theories share a fundamental skepticism about law's supposed neutrality and objectivity.
They argue it's not neutral at all.
Pretty much. The core critique is that law is, in fact, a social and political construct. And it often functions, consciously or unconsciously, to maintain existing power structures and serve the interests of dominant groups.
Can you give an example?
Sure. A Marxist lens might look at contract law or property law and argue it's primarily designed to protect capital and the interests of the owning class. Feminist jurisprudence might analyze self-defense laws, for instance, and show how standards based on male experiences might fail to protect women adequately in situations of domestic abuse.
So they're saying, look behind the curtain of equality before the law and ask, who actually benefits here? Whose perspective is embedded in these rules?
Precisely. It's a call to be critical, to question the assumptions underlying the legal system.
Okay, that's a lot of ground covered. Let's try to pull out some key themes, the big messages Wax wants us to take away. What's the first one that really stands out?
For me, it's got to be theme one, the enduring tension between law and morality. This isn't just theory. Wax shows how it plays out constantly. Every time there's a debate about a controversial law, abortion, euthanasia, free speech limits, we're essentially wrestling with this. How much should morality influence law? Is the certainty of positive law worth enforcing something that feels deeply unjust?
Yeah, it forces you to ask where your own line is, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, what's another key theme?
I think theme two is the role of the judge. Are they just a mechanic applying rules or an interpreter finding meaning? Understanding the difference between Hart's view and Dworkin's helps you analyze what courts are actually doing.
Right. When people talk about judicial activism, this debate is often lurking underneath.
Exactly. Are judges neutrally applying pre-existing rules, or are they, as Dworkin suggests, engaged in a kind of moral and political reasoning to make the law the best it can be? It really matters for how we see the court's power.
And a third one, the critical perspectives seem crucial here.
Definitely. Theme three, law as an instrument of power and social control. Wax includes these critical voices to force us to look beyond the formal legal rules and ask those tough questions. Is the system truly fair? Or does it tend to reinforce existing inequalities, whether based on class, gender, race, or something else? It makes you a more critical observer.
Okay, those are powerful themes. Wax also packs the book with some really memorable lines or ideas that capture these big concepts.
It does. They're great mental shortcuts. Let's start with the natural law classic. An unjust law is no law at all. Lex injusta non est lex.
Simple, but profound. It's that assertion that law needs a moral foundation to command genuine obedience. It gives you a basis for saying, no, I won't follow that.
Then for the other side, legal positivism, there's that quote summarizing the separation thesis. The existence of law is one thing, its merit or demerit is another.
That's the clinical view, almost. It allows for detached analysis. We can identify what the law is according to the system's rules, even while we might strongly disagree with its morality. It keeps things distinct.
Right. And maybe one more from the legal realist tradition, which Wax also touches on, often linked to Justice Holmes. The life of the law has not been logic. It has been experience.
Ah, I like that. It reminds us law isn't just abstract reasoning in textbooks.
Exactly. It's shaped by how it's actually applied, by social context, by the biases and experiences of the people, especially judges involved. It's about law in action, not just law on the books.
So, having wrestled with all these ideas, how does this actually help you, the listener, in everyday life? Is it just interesting theory?
Wax argues, and I think he's right, that it's actually very empowering. First, it helps you become a more informed citizen.
That's so.
Well, when you follow political debates about new laws or court rulings, think about things like free speech codes, immigration rules, environmental regulations, you can start to see the underlying philosophical arguments.
You can recognize if someone's making a natural law type argument about inherent rights versus a positivist argument about following democratic procedures.
Exactly. It helps you move beyond just agreeing or disagreeing based on gut feeling and engage more critically with the reasons being given.
Okay, that makes sense. What about on a more personal level?
Well, it can help navigate personal ethical dilemmas, especially around civil disobedience.
When is it right to break the law?
The philosophy gives you a framework for thinking about that. Natural law, for instance, provides a potential justification if a law is fundamentally unjust, violating basic moral principles, then maybe there is a moral case for disobeying it. It helps you think through the principles involved rather than just reacting emotionally.
That's a really practical application. So, thinking back on the book, what was the biggest takeaway for you? What really stuck?
For me, it was how effectively Wax demolishes that simple, maybe comforting idea of law as just a clear set of rules in a book. He shows it's so much more dynamic, so contested. The big lesson isn't an answer. It's the realization that law is fundamentally about ongoing questions. Questions about justice, authority, morality.
Yeah, I agree. It replaces that simplistic view with something much richer and maybe more demanding. It makes you think.
And that really leads to Wax's final point, doesn't it? He argues, in the end, that thinking about jurisprudence, about the philosophy of law, isn't just for academics. It's an essential skill for any engaged citizen.
A civic responsibility, almost.
You could say that. Understanding the ideas behind the rules that shape our lives gives you the power to scrutinize them, to understand your own place in the legal system, and to participate more meaningfully in shaping its future.
It's a short book, but it certainly packs a philosophical punch. Really valuable guide.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.